It is Tuesday, August 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, China cuts interest rates after another day of falling stocks. North and South Korea reach an accord in their latest confrontation.
It is somewhat of a compromise because the wording is just short of an actual apology. The word apologized. It does not exist in the deal.
And we look at how society can try to prevent violence among its youth. It's all ahead. Chinese markets extended Monday's rout with a benchmark Shanghai index ending Tuesday more than 7% lower after Monday's nearly 9% dive. Other regional markets were mixed, with Tokyo and Hong Kong lower, while others, including Seoul and Sydney, posting gains. European markets opened higher, while U.S. stock futures also anticipated gains on Tuesday. In New York Monday, the benchmark Dow Jones plummeted 1,000 points before ending the day down nearly 600, or 3.6%. Meanwhile, Beijing announced it was cutting interest rates. Although China's weakening economy and surprise currency devaluation played a part in the global downturn, Peterson Institute for International Economics economist Gary Huffbauer tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that's not the whole story.
There are doubts about the rate of Chinese growth because you look at the statistics, which are pretty concrete: exports, imports, industrial production, energy. They all seem to indicate a much slower growth than this advertised 7% figure. Secondly, the Chinese stock market had a rally that was just unbelievable. And when I was in Shanghai a couple of months ago, I was bold enough to say, you know, this is unsustainable. Chinese shares got to price earnings ratios of 50, 60 on average, not just the star companies, but on average. And that was way out of bounds, given that the economy wasn't growing at 10%. It was maybe growing at 5%. The Chinese stock market has now given up all the gains that it made during the year in what I think was a classic bubble phenomenon. In the U.S. and elsewhere, growth is, it's not terrible, but it's disappointing. Latin America is almost flat. Europe is just slowly coming out. U.S. is doing the best, but it's not really a boom time here. It's just doing okay. With that kind of growth, it doesn't look like, you know, corporate profits are going to increase at the rate investors had expected. And then the third thing is fear that the Federal Reserve is going to pull the trigger, as they say, which means increase interest rates for the first time in 5 years in the month of September. Put all that together with a stock market which had been very strong with hardly any corrections of any size for 5 years, which is again abnormal. And today and Friday were the paydays. The big question now is whether this is just a correction, which has been defined by Wall Streeters as a drop of about 10 to 15%, or whether it's the beginning of a bear market.
You mentioned a comment earlier about the Chinese growth rate. The target rate this year is 7%. Are you thinking they're not going to make that?
I don't think they'll make that. No, I think they've exaggerated the GDP growth based on what I've seen from lots of other statistical series. And I think the real growth is probably more like 5 or 6%.
Oil prices, meanwhile, are down to a 6.5-year low, below $40 a barrel.
Well, that reflects this tremendous success in the U.S. in fracking. And the fact that once you put in a fracking well, the oil keeps flowing without doing very much. Well, we're not drilling many new wells now. We have a whole lot of wells that have been drilled, and they're not going to stop producing. And other producers around the world, they all are concerned about losing market share. You know, Iran says it's going to increase production come what may. Saudi Arabia says we're not going to decrease. Nobody wants to cut back production.
That's economist Gary Huffbauer. Well, concerns about the Chinese economy have been shaking up global markets in recent days. But as we hear from VOA's Bill Eyde in Beijing, most indices in Asia finished trading higher on Tuesday.
Over the past year, China's main stock market in Shanghai has been on a roller coaster ride, more than doubling to 5,100 points in June, even as the Chinese economy continued to show signs that it was slowing to its close on Tuesday, which was nearing levels of where the market was a year ago. When the plunge began in June, the government pulled out all the stops to provide the market with what it called ample liquidity. And that support lasted through July and early August. But now the government appears to be sitting on the sideline, and that is worrying small retail investors. One elderly investor surnamed Gao voiced his concern that China's stocks were falling more than global markets, noting that while they have fallen by several percentage points, China's markets were falling by 8 or 10%. He says that average people cannot afford it, arguing that it was not right for the government not to save the market. China's dramatic slide over the past week and the release of more poor economic data has hit global equity and commodity markets hard in recent days. But most markets in Asia, aside from Japan, appeared to close in positive territory on Tuesday. Chinese state media made little mention of the volatility in the market on Tuesday, with state television spending a large part of the day focused on preparations for a massive military parade in Beijing next week to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. On major websites, news of the market's continued turmoil was present, but conspicuously lower on the page. Overseas, some sought to cool concerns about the fluctuations in China's market and the possible impact on its broader economy and consumer sentiment. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says there is no need to hyperventilate. He says that from time to time, stock market corrections and the bursting of bubbles can spill over into other markets. In a rare comment midway through the financial quarter, Apple CEO Tim Cook talked about his company's business. In an emailed response to questions from the Wall Street Journal about a pickup of iPhone activations over the past few weeks in China, Cook wrote that while he obviously cannot predict the future, performance so far this quarter looked reassuring. He also voiced his belief that China represents an unprecedented opportunity over the long term. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. So, Andrew, what is the response to this turmoil in global markets?
Well, it's been a huge response. And I want to start actually with something that Bill, I just mentioned about Steve Jobs sending this email to Jim Cramer as a financial reporter here in the U.S. saying, oh, the mid-quarter, we're looking good. A lot of people pointing out on social media that Tim Cook could face some issues with the SEC. It may be illegal that he sent that email at some kind of gray area. So more potentially to follow on that. But that was something that was trending on social media yesterday. We talked about yesterday morning hashtag Black Monday. And that, of course, trended all throughout the day yesterday. When we talked about it, the U.S. markets had yet to open. And so as we saw throughout the day, the social media kind of trended along with the markets. When the Dow went down initially, 1,089 points was the lowest it got to. People were saying, that's it. My retirement's gone. As it kind of creeped back up and started to make a recovery towards midday, people were saying, is it okay to get back into the market? People kind of questioning that on social media. And then by the end of the day, as it started to dive again, they said, well, this is clearly not a good time to get back in. We spoke too soon. So it's been interesting how that's kind of tracked along through social media. A lot of people making a lot of jokes. I guess they figure if you're facing such a dire situation, especially when money's involved, you know, least you can do is, I guess, joke about it and try to put a positive spin on it, or at least a funny one. But we're sure to see more of that today. Maybe hashtag brighter Tuesday. It's looking like maybe some of the markets will be up today as opposed to yesterday. So we'll see. Two other stories from Facebook and Twitter. From Facebook, they have on the side of their page different topics that are trending, and they're releasing information about how they determine what those topics are. They're saying that they have to be topics that are mentioned a lot and topics that see an increase in mention, and they use the example of Justin Bieber. They say Justin Bieber's always getting mentioned a lot on Facebook, so he's not going to be trending necessarily, because even though he's being mentioned a lot, that's consistent. It has to be kind of a spike. And what I found interesting about this, they said once a topic's identified, it's approved by an actual person who writes a little headline on Facebook. But they said that person doesn't pick what's trending. They just get to write the headline. So there is at least one person involved in some control of that. And then from Twitter, a big trending story. Twitter was allowing companies for the past couple years to look through politicians' deleted tweets to see what they had said, to hold them accountable for maybe comments or positions they had said in the past. Well, they're not doing that anymore. They stopped doing that in the U.S. past June. And now they're no longer allowing that in 30 different countries around the world as of this Sunday. So a lot of people in transparency saying this is a bad move on Twitter's part. Twitter saying they're trying to keep it so that everyone is equal on Twitter. People are contending politicians should be held to a higher standard. So that back and forth is likely to continue, especially as the election heats up here in the U.S.
No doubt as it will. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
I'm always glad myself with a delete because sometimes I put
no need
out
to worry that an asteroid will destroy the Earth in September. The internet has been abuzz recently with a viral rumor that life on Earth will be wiped out by a massive asteroid sometime near the end of September. The folks at NASA beg to differ and have had to come out with a statement they hope will defuse this rumor of doom. Paul Trottis, manager of NASA's Near Earth Object Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, says that there is not one shred of scientific evidence that an asteroid or any other celestial object will hit the Earth on those dates. NASA says that they haven't seen any asteroids or comets that would smack into the Earth in the foreseeable future. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, efforts to limit violence among the young. An end to South Korean propaganda broadcasts into North Korea and an expression of regret from Pyongyang over the wounding of two South Korean soldiers in a mine blast are the highlights of a six-point agreement between the two Koreas following recent tensions some feared would lead to military confrontation. South Korean President Park Geun-hye expressed hope the deal would provide a turnaround on other issues. The announcement was also welcomed by the United States, which has 28,000 troops in South Korea. John Kirby is a U.S. State Department spokesman.
We support President Park's tireless efforts to improve inter-Korean relations, which support peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. We continue to coordinate closely with the ROK and to reiterate our unwavering support for the alliance. This was obviously a compromise by both sides. That's not insignificant all by itself. We hope that it will contribute to decreased tensions, and we're just going to have to see how it plays out. What's important here is that the two sides did get together. They did come to an agreement that they both found mutually satisfactory, and that's the important thing. And that tensions now, which had been running pretty high over the last several days, have an opportunity to decrease a little bit.
That's U.S. spokesman John Kirby in Washington. James Kim is a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's a good deal because it led to a de-escalation of the crisis.
It is somewhat of a compromise because the wording is just short of an actual apology. The word apologize does not exist in the deal. So from the North side, they use the word regret, which is very common based on past statements like this that North Korea has used. And from South Korea's side, President Park, if you recall, previous to the agreement, had expressed publicly that anything short of an apology would not lead to takedown of the speakers and the broadcast. So South Korea somewhat gave on its end, and also North Korea also made some compromising moves as well.
Well, the two Koreas have been here before, and they've backed away from the brink of conflict.
That's right. It's neither in both sides' interest and either side's interest to have this escalate into a full-blown war, because the losses would be terrible. It would be unthinkable from both sides' point of view. These provocations which lead to escalation and then, you know, lead to some sort of a talk and then de-escalation, this kind of a cycle is not unusual, especially when things get tougher in North Korea.
Are you optimistic that there will be further talks, perhaps even on family reunions?
The onus is on both sides. There are 6 points to this agreement, and onus is on both sides to see through the implementation of this deal. And we will have to wait and see how that works out. All options are still open on the table past the third point in the deal, I believe, which is the stopping of the loudspeaker broadcast. So points 1, 2, and 3, maybe there may be some more talks. Yes, I think that North Korea has done its part in expressing regret over the landmine incidents, and South Korea decommissioning the loudspeakers. And then beyond that, 4, 5, and 6, we would have to wait and see whether North Korea actually pulls the troops out away from the demilitarized zone in the border area, whether there will be any kind of family reunions or discussions about this matter, and whether there will be other kinds of exchanges regarding NGOs. Those are matters that we would have to wait and see whether both sides follow through on those.
Well, James, as you know, there's been this endless cycle of talks followed by tensions, followed by reconciliation efforts, but nothing has ever seemed to break this constant cycle. Do you think this is different this time?
I'm less optimistic that this particular incident would lead to any changes in North Korean behavior, given those patterns that you speak of. If there isn't any change, then essentially what might happen in the future is that some of these kinds of escalatory crisis situations can lead to a full-blown military conflict.
That's James Kim of the Osan Institute for Policy Studies. He was speaking from Seoul. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Violence among young people seems to be getting worse in the U.S. and elsewhere. Author Jan Arno considers youth violence in her latest book, In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World. And in the second part of a conversation with International Edition Susan Yaki, she considers what parents and society can do to deter violence among the young.
Yesterday, we spoke with author Jan Arno about violence among youth, and today we continue our conversation. Jan, basically it seems like if the adults would behave properly, their children are more likely to behave properly. But this is sort of a catch-22 situation because these adults are behaving badly because maybe they witnessed violence as a child.
Exactly. And so parents and adults, and of course all adults raise children even if they don't have their own, because almost every economic decision we make has an impact on children. But if the adults would learn how to reboot their own behavior, the next generations of children are going to be a lot less prone to violence.
What can society as a whole do here?
Society as a whole, first of all, can make sure that they teach their children empathy, not sympathy. Sympathy is kind of an outside the ring attitude. But empathy is where you actually feel something that the other person is experiencing. Teaching the child empathy by your own actions, showing empathy, is very, very big. So, for example, that translates into the playground, where if a child is being bullying and you have empathy for that child, or even for the bully, you're able to do something about it even as a child. So showing empathy is a big thing. Being there for your children, being in your child's life as opposed to on the outskirts of your children's lives, is very, very important. So showing up is a big deal. Not abdicating your responsibility as a parent to the television and to the computer and the video game. Speaking of computers, it's really good to have the computer, the family computer, in the family room or the kitchen so you can monitor what your children are doing. Knowing who your children's friends are is very important. And putting your foot down about not fraternizing with certain children if you feel that their influence is bad for your child. Also, keeping the lines of communication open, very, very important. So many kids today don't want to have anything to do with their parents. They will not speak with their parents. They will not divulge information. I have over 400 things in my book, 400 very easy-to-do solutions that all cost nothing that parents, caregivers, and other people who are in the lives of children can do to help alleviate this problem of violence that we, by the way, have created for our children. We should stop blaming the victims, that's another thing, and start looking at ourselves to see what we have created for them.
And this is something people can get from your book. And the name of that book again?
It's called In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today, Jan. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
That's author Jan Arno, and she was speaking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. Well, that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
70 years ago this month, the victors of the Second World War, horrified by crimes committed by the Nazi regime, issued a decree for the prosecution of three crimes: crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The decree, now known as the Nuremberg or London Charter, established that perpetrators of murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against the civilian population before or during the war could not hide behind their official position in government, nor their obedience to orders from above, to avoid criminal responsibility for participating in such horrendous acts. Since then, these principles have served as the basis for successive provisions on war crimes and crimes against humanity in the statutes of international hybrid and domestic tribunals that have charged and prosecuted hundreds of individuals, from the foot soldier all the way up to the head of state, for such crimes. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia indicted 161 people for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide committed during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. Including former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and other political and military leaders. Similarly, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted 93 individuals accused of being responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide, including dozens of political and military officials. And in Sierra Leone, a special hybrid court convicted, among others, former Liberian President Charles Taylor for his role in aiding, abetting, and planning atrocities committed by rebels in the civil war there. At one point, these individuals may have believed that they would never have to answer for their crimes. They might have felt justified in perpetrating atrocities because their actions were part either of government policy or of a wide practice that was tolerated or condoned by the government. but no one is above the law. From sexual violence in eastern Congo to the brutal torture in the Assad regime's prisons in Syria, we will continue to seek accountability for the world's worst crimes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the London Charter. Such accountability is a stabilizing force in international affairs, and it is what our values and the memory of the victims demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.